You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part 13 of a series in the book of Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 17, verse 1. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons and to all the people of Israel, and say to them, this is the thing that the Lord has commanded. If anyone of the house of Israel kills an ox or a lamb or a goat in the camp, or kills it outside the camp, and does not bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting to offer it as a gift to the Lord in front of the tabernacle of the Lord, blood guilt shall be imputed to that man. He has shed blood, and that man shall be cut off from among his people. This is to the end that the people of Israel may bring their sacrifices that they sacrifice in the open field, and that they may bring them to the Lord, to the priest at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and sacrifice them as sacrifices of peace offerings to the Lord. And the priest shall throw the blood on the altar of the Lord at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and burn the fat for a pleasing aroma to the Lord. So they shall no more sacrifice their sacrifices to goat demons after whom they whore. This shall be a statute forever for them throughout their generations. And you shall say to them, any one of the house of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn among them, who offers a burnt offering for sacrifice and does not bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting to offer it to the Lord, that man shall be cut off from his people." We'll pause there after verse 9. And what this little section is concerned about is the correct place for sacrifice. And we've seen already in this book the sacrifices that God instituted. And we've seen how the priesthood was appointed for that. We've seen that the tabernacle was the central place, the place to which the sacrifices were to be brought. But if you're familiar with the history of the nation of Israel, you will know that that's not always what the people did. In fact, already in the book of Leviticus, we have the incident of Aaron's sons being killed by God because they brought strange fire. Again, as we commented on that passage, we weren't certain exactly what it was that they did wrong, but in some way they contravened the standard and rules of sacrifice that God had given. And here God is being very, very clear in the strongest possible terms about the importance of bringing sacrifices to the tabernacle. Now, if you start to read the chapter, you might think that what God is doing is restricting the killing of animals to only killing them for use in sacrifice or only killing them inside the camp. As if they were to limit the amount of meat that they eat and it was wrong to kill animals outside that context. But it becomes clear as you read on down the verses that the issue here is not generally with killing of meat. Nowhere does God forbid the Israelites from eating meat or say that they're only to eat meat when it's involved in the sacrificial system. But actually what God does is what God is doing here is to say that this is where they're to bring their sacrifices to. And it's verse 7 really that makes that clear, that some of the people had been offering sacrifices to goat demons after whom they were whoring. That idea of prostitution, of course, is a key image in God's relationship with Israel. God describes himself as Israel's husband, or Israel as his bride. And the covenant relationship that he has with Israel is akin to the marriage relationship between a man and a woman. And so when Israel goes off to worship other gods, or people from the nation of Israel do that, it's like prostitution. They're going off like making themselves a prostitute to other gods. And so what God is saying here is that there is only one place to which they should bring their sacrifices, and that is to the legitimate priesthood in front of the tabernacle of God. Again, verses 8 and 9 make it clear that this applies not just to the people of Israel, but to the strangers, foreigners who live among them, who sojourn among them. And if they bring burnt offerings, they have to bring them to the entrance of the tent of meeting. And the penalty, if this isn't done, is the strongest possible penalty. It's to be cut off from among his people. That idea of cutting off could mean one of two things. It could mean that the person is executed, they forfeit their life, they lose their life. On the other hand, it could mean exclusion from the nation, being put out of the nation, ostracized and alienated. And this is about purity of worship. God is saying that the nation of Israel is to worship only him. And they're to do that in the way that God has appointed. There is a centralized dimension to it. They're not to bring these sacrifices to other locations. They're not to set up other altars, because if they do, the temptation is too strong for them to be worshiping other gods. So this centralized nature of the worship of God is a reminder of, and a constant reminder of, both their unity as a people, but more importantly, of the unity of God, the one God that they worship, the true God, Yahweh, who has redeemed them and to whom they are covenanted. And this is a mark of faithfulness to him. So a very stark warning in that first section of the chapter. Let's read on then, Leviticus chapter 17, verse 10. If any one of the house of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn among them eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood and will cut him off from among his people. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it for you on the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement by the life. Therefore, I have said to the people of Israel, no person among you shall eat blood, neither shall any stranger who sojourns among you eat blood. Anyone also of the people of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn among them, who takes in hunting any beast or bird that may be eaten, shall pour out its blood and cover it with earth. For the life of every creature is its blood is its life. Therefore, I have said to the people of Israel, you shall not eat the blood of any creature. For the life of every creature is its blood. Whoever eats it shall be cut off. And every person who eats what dies of itself or what is torn by beasts, whether he is a native or a sojourner, shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until that evening. Then he shall be clean. But if he does not wash them or bathe his flesh, he shall bear his iniquity. Now again, we've seen already at the beginning of this chapter, in the first section, how the sacrifices involving blood have to be performed in the one place, the correct place. Those animals have to be brought to the entrance of the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, to the properly appointed priesthood. But here we're seeing that there is a broader issue with blood for the nation of Israel, and we're given the reason why blood is treated with such significance. We've seen it as we've read about the sacrifices, how the blood was used in the sacrifices, sprinkled on the altar, and in the case of the Day of Atonement, was sprinkled on the mercy seat on top of the ark and on the front of the ark of the covenant. Blood was a very central part of that sacrificial system. But there was also a very clear prohibition. We've seen already in Leviticus about clean foods, which animals and types of creatures are clean to eat and which are not. But here is this prohibition, this clear prohibition against eating blood. And it's not something that is new in Leviticus. It's something that is consistent in the Old Testament law. But in fact, it goes back even further than that. In Genesis 9, after the flood, when God first allows human beings to eat animals, it seems that before that they were probably vegetarian, but then God gives permission after the flood for animals to be used for food, presumably as a way of sustaining a growing population. But for the meat of animals to be used for food, it may well have been that dairy farming and milk, growing of milk and so on, or use of milk rather, growing, keeping of animals for milk was legitimate before. We know, for example, that Cain, the son of Adam, was a livestock farmer or had flocks. But the killing of animals seems to have only been legitimate before that for sacrificial purposes. But after the flood, God gives permission to eat animals, but he makes it clear that they should not eat blood. And that led, of course, to the Jewish and also the Muslim, borrowed from Judaism, the Muslim practice of draining the blood from an animal whenever it's being slaughtered for food. And so this is a very strong prohibition. Again, it's for the people of Israel and for the strangers, the foreigners who sojourn amongst them. And it says that God will set his face against the person and cut him off. Again, it's similar to bringing the wrong type of sacrifices. If they eat blood, that's what will happen. Why though? Because the life of the flesh is in the blood, and because blood is used in the sacrifices of atonement. So two reasons. One, blood has a special part in the sacrificial system. And two, then blood is the life-sustaining force, the lifeblood. We still have that phrase in English, don't we? Now, of course, you could question that from a modern scientific perspective. Is that really true? It's not as if blood is alive. But when blood is pumping around the body, that sustains life. And that's still true with all of our modern medical and veterinary knowledge, isn't it? That if the blood stops pumping around, life will soon cease. Blood flow is necessary to sustain life. If blood is lost, too much blood, life will cease. If blood stops pumping because the heart stops, life will cease. If blood cannot be oxygenated well from the air because the lungs are not functioning well, life will cease. And so there is no doubt that blood is important for sustaining life, and the flow of blood is indicative of the presence of life. And so this prohibition on eating blood is supported by that fact, as well as the sacrificial system. And then the second part of these commands is to do with animals that are to be eaten, that have been taken in hunting. The blood is not to be poured out on the earth. It seems it's to be treated with a particular type of respect. Now, whether that's because pouring out of blood on the earth and covering it with soil was part of pagan rituals of worship is unclear. Again, it's possible as you read these verses to think that it's only in sacrifice that animals should be killed. Every animal that you want to eat, if you're going to kill it, you bring the blood to God. But again, that doesn't seem to be what's being taught here or what is actually practiced by the people of Israel. But there is this prohibition on pouring out of blood. Blood is to be treated with respect. And then again, verse 15, there's the third part of this, which is that if an animal dies of itself or is torn by beasts, of course, in which case you can't guarantee that the blood has been removed. You can't drain the blood as they normally would have done in slaughtering the animal. So it's not wrong to eat that animal, but it does make the person unclean and they need to be cleansed. So they're unclean until the evening. They have to be cleansed with washing the clothes and washing themselves in order to come back into ritual cleanliness and inclusion amongst in the worship of God's people. Let's read on then into Leviticus chapter 18. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. You shall not do as they do in the land of Egypt where you lived, and you shall not do as they do in the land of Canaan to which I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes. You shall follow my rules and keep my statutes and walk in them. I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my rules. If a person does them, he shall live by them. I am the Lord. None of you shall approach any one of his close relatives to uncover nakedness. I am the Lord. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father, which is the nakedness of your mother. She is your mother. You shall not uncover her nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's wife. It is your father's nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your sister, your father's daughter, or your mother's daughter, whether brought up in the family or in another home. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your son's daughter or of your daughter's daughter, for their nakedness is your own nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's wife's daughter, brought up in your father's family, since she is your sister. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's sister. She is your father's relative. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your mother's sister, for she is your mother's relative. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's brother. That is, you shall not approach his wife. She is your aunt. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your daughter-in-law. She is your son's wife. You shall not uncover her nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your brother's wife. It is your brother's nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of a woman and of her daughter, and you shall not take her son's daughter or her daughter's daughter to uncover her nakedness. They are relatives. It is depravity, and you shall not take a woman as a rival wife to her sister, uncovering her nakedness while her sister is still alive. Let's pause there after verse 18. Now again, this phrase, uncovering of nakedness, clearly has sexual connotations. Again, in the first part of this episode, when we thought about eating blood, we thought back to Genesis 9, and after the flood, the instructions that God gave to Moses. But also in the story of Moses, we read about his son Ham uncovering his father's nakedness. This is not an issue of accidentally seeing somebody naked. This is of intentionally uncovering their nakedness, or I'm sure also spying on them when they are naked. And of course, the implication is, and quite possibly in the case of Ham and Noah, that there was more than just looking at his naked father. It was a sexual act that Ham committed. And I think that's what's in view in this chapter. Although I don't want to stress that too much, because I think the fact that the covering of nakedness goes right back to Genesis 3. To the fact that Adam and Eve, whenever they fell into sin, instinctively wanted to cover their nakedness, and God provides a covering for their nakedness, even more significantly out of animal skins. It seems that God is the first person to kill animals, and he does it to create clothing, which, in going back to the first part of this episode, we saw that when animals are killed for food, the blood is not to be consumed, but the killing of animals for clothing is a different matter again. So why I'm saying that is that the covering of nakedness is an appropriate and necessary thing in our sin-stained world, because nakedness is inevitably associated with sexual temptation. Now, of course, there are liberal attitudes around, and sometimes those folks will say, well, look, you know, that's a bit sad that you can't look at nakedness without being tempted sexually. And we're not saying that everybody who ever sees a naked person is tempted to have sex with them. There are situations when it's necessary to expose the private parts of the body to a doctor, for example. There are times when you might see someone and not be lusting after them. But the normal pattern is for us to cover up the sexual parts of our body. We know what those are, those parts that are stimulating. Again, it's hard to generalize and it's hard to know, isn't it? But classically, people might think, well, those kind of visual temptations and stimuli are stronger for men than for women. So again, looking at nakedness is not something that is biblically warranted, because there is always the possibility of a sexual dimension. And in fact, as you read through this, it becomes clear that there are appropriate people who can look at the nakedness of a person. So the way of describing the nakedness of the wife as being her husband's nakedness, it is quite significant, because it's not a possessive thing in a sense that her body belongs to him, and therefore it's a shame, you know, for another man, he's infringing on that man's ownership of her body. But it is saying that there is a proper context in which nakedness can be enjoyed and celebrated, and that is within marriage. And that's the important point here, that if you follow the trajectory, the kind of emphasis of this chapter, although this section that we've read is about sexual desire for and nakedness of and acts that then require nakedness, physical sexual acts with close relatives, and the relatives are quite clearly listed, uncles and aunts, parents, siblings, even adoptive siblings or siblings of a wife of the father, half siblings, and daughters-in-law and brothers' wives and so on. all of this is prefaced with the importance of marriage, because the proper place for the nakedness is in the context of marriage. That's the standard, of course, that the Old Testament sets. It's the only form of sexual intimacy that the Old Testament legitimates, that it approves of. But in that context of marriage, sex is a very good gift. And nakedness is to be enjoyed. There shouldn't be shame between a married couple. In that sense, Adam and Eve's shame at their nakedness was an odd thing, because there was nobody else there to see them. But it was an instinctive realization of their guilt before God that led to that shame. But in this chapter, the nakedness issue and the sexual issue is more to do with purity, with the reason for which sexual desire is given within marriage, for the strengthening of the marriage, for procreation, and for enjoyment within that marriage, mutual benefit. Let's read on then, verse 19. You shall not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness while she is in her menstrual uncleanness, and you shall not lie sexually with your neighbor's wife, and so make yourself unclean with her. You shall not give any of your children to offer them to Molech, and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination. And you shall not lie with any animal, and so make yourself unclean with it. Neither shall any woman give herself to an animal to lie with it. It is a perversion. Again, now, these are other restrictions around sexual activities, with the possible exception of verse 21, the giving of children to Molech, which is often thought of as being child sacrifice, killing a child to the god Molech. But given the way this comes in the middle of a chapter that seems to be about sexual impurity. The Hebrew for that offering them is literally to make them pass through, with the sense of passing through the fire. So it seems that children were offered in burnt sacrifice to Molech. But it seems that as we read this in this context, there might also have been a sexual element of that, maybe a cultic sexual child abuse going on before the children were killed as a burnt offering to Molech. Or perhaps that whole thing is a euphemism for child prostitution or child abuse. But certainly what we're reading here, well, the menstrual uncleanness is probably to do with the issue of blood, because, of course, cleanness, we've already seen earlier in Leviticus that a woman is ritually unclean during her menstruation. And so for a man to come in physical contact with her will, of course, make him unclean. But the prohibition against adultery in verse 20 is consistent with the Ten Commandments. Then verse 21 about the children, verse 22 about homosexual activity, and verse 23 about bestiality. All of these things are a deviation from the normal. So again, menstruation is a problem partly or largely because of the blood, but perhaps also because there is no possibility of procreation. Now, that does not mean that sex is bad and only becomes legitimate if there is a possibility of procreation. That would be wrong biblically, because scripture never makes that explicit. But again, there is meant to be a time where the woman's body is not sexually active, and that is tied with her cycle of fertility as well. And homosexuality is clearly not God's design. There is no possibility of procreation. It is not within the context of loving covenant commitment in marriage, just as adultery is not in verse 20. And verse 23, bestiality clearly is not part of God's design. God made Eve for Adam, a helper who is fit for him, not some other animal who he could satisfy his physical lust with. So all of these things, and it's important, of course, that all of these sins belong together, isn't it? Cultural attitudes may change. We live in a culture now where homosexual activity is legal and approved of, even in a marriage relationship that is approved of in many of our cultures. Certainly where I live in the UK, that's the case. But bestiality would still be frowned upon or illegal. Certainly, again, in the UK, that might be different in different cultures. So there are some things that our culture or our society may see as unacceptable, generally the issue of consent, as long as it's between two adults who consent, it's seen as okay in the legal terms. But biblically, that's not God's standard. God's standard is that there is a proper context for sexual activity, and that is within marriage, and that's consistent throughout the Bible. There is no positive word about homosexual activity in Scripture. And so we're not saying that people are condemned because they have a desire or an attraction to people of the same sex, but to act upon that is sinful. Just as to commit adultery is sinful, or incest with a close relative is sinful, or bestiality is sinful, or sex during menstruation is sinful. So these are things that God prohibits. Let's finish off the chapter then, verses 24 to 30. Do not make yourselves unclean by any of these things, for by all these the nations I am driving out before you have become unclean, and the land became unclean, so that I punished its iniquity, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. But you shall keep my statutes and my rules, and do none of these abominations, either the native or the stranger who sojourns among you. For the people of the land who were before you did all of these abominations, so that the land became unclean, lest the land vomit you out and make it unclean, as it vomited out the nation that was before you. For everyone who does any of these abominations, the persons who do them shall be cut off from among their people. So keep my charge never to practice any of these abominable customs that were practiced before you, and never to make yourselves unclean by them. I am the Lord your God. So again, a very strong prohibition, just as we saw in the first part of this episode as regards eating blood or bringing sacrifices to a location other than the tabernacle. This cutting off, this being put out from among the people, sexual purity matters. And it matters in a sense that we don't often think of. This is not just about private behavior. Not just a matter of private morality for Israel, it is about public morality. It is about the law of the land. Now again, I'm not saying that Christians should try to impose Christian morality on the law of our nations today. I think we need to realize that our nations have departed from a Christian moral foundation. But what we do read here is that God judged the nations, not Israel, or not only Israel, but the nations that inhabited the land before them. One of the reasons why God gave the land of Canaan to the Israelites was because the sin of the Canaanites had reached its fullness, to use the phrase that God used with Abraham when he told him that it would be 400 years before his descendants would inherit the land that God had promised to him. And he said it was until the sins of those nations had reached their full level, had kind of bubbled up to the level at which God would act in judgment through the Israelites. And so we have a good basis for saying that God can and does judge nations because of sexual impurity and of approval of sexual impurity. Romans chapter 1 also implies the same thing. Not because sexual impurity in itself is the only sin. It's part of a whole pattern of sinfulness, of course. It's a marker, though, of a society that has gone very far from God's standards. And not only that, but sexual sin is particularly important, according to the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 6 and 7, when he writes about this, because it is a sin against one's own body. We're using our body for a purpose that God did not create it for, and therefore we're using our body in a wrong way. And so sexual sin is treated very seriously by God. And God is right to judge when sexual immorality is approved of. But as we look at that, let's not single out one of these sins. Let's think all of us. What has God given you your body for? How are you using it sexually in a wrong way? For example, through use of pornography or lusting after people who are not your wife or your husband, or an affair, or flirtation if you're married or not, or being sexually active without that covenant commitment of marriage, or homosexual activity, any of these things, purify yourself. Be thankful that there is forgiveness for all of these things in Christ. When Paul lists the sins that the Corinthian church had been experiencing before they came to faith, he includes amongst that homosexual activity as an example. And so there is forgiveness, there is restoration, there is inclusion amongst the people of God for those who confess these sins and who repent of them. But there is also help from God to be sexually pure, and that's never been more important than it is today in a sex-mad society, a society where nakedness is widespread, sexual temptation is used even to sell things that have nothing to do with sex, and there are no inhibitions about talking about these things. Let's seek purity. Let's take that seriously. Let's remember that God gave us our bodies, including their sexual function, for a purpose. And that purpose is marriage and the intimacy of marriage and the family unit that is born through marriage. And if God gives us children, through procreation as a gift within that context. Let's make that our standard. Let's have grace for those who fall short of it. But let's uphold that standard in our teaching and in our lives. And in what we model and expect from God's people. And let's try and influence our society to take sex more seriously. Our society's problem is not that it thinks too much of sex. It might think too much about sex, too often about sex, but it thinks too little of sex. It doesn't realize the wonderful gift that it is from God in the right context.